This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Annie's Law, a new Ohio law imposing stiffer penalties on drunk drivers, took effect in April. The law is named for Andy Rooney, who was 36 years old when she was killed by a repeat drunk driver on July 4th, 2013. Here to discuss the law and how it's meant to better protect us are the Honorable Kurt Kissinger, a judge on the Hamilton County Municipal Court and chair of the court's Criminal and Traffic Law Committee, Teresa Hayes, state director with Life Safer, an ignition interlock provider, and Dr. Walt Rooney, Annie Rooney's older brother, and he also sits on the National Board of Directors of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And you can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Walt, Teresa, and Kurt, thank you for joining us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Thanks. Thank you for having us.
Walt, tell us about what happened to Annie back in 2013.
Sure. My little sister, Annie, was a practicing attorney in Bozeman, Montana, and she had recently moved back to the Ohio area to practice law. And she actually was a prosecutor for DUI cases and domestic violence cases. And she was driving on the night of the 4th of July, 2013, in her Lincoln Navigator. And the Lincoln Navigator was chosen because one of the largest production cars and had a great safety record. My family sort of grew up watching my father, who was a general surgeon, take care of trauma victims at all hours of the night in southern Ohio. So we were acutely aware of things that could happen on the road. So she was coming back from a friend's house around dusk on the 4th of July. And as she was driving down Route 50 just outside of Chillicothe, Ohio, let me back up 5 minutes. So 5 to 10 minutes before that, there were multiple 911 calls that someone was driving at a high rate of speed without their lights, without stopping at stop signs, without stopping at stop lights, and nearly hitting multiple people for maybe almost 20 minutes. And the person then proceeded to drive down Route 50 up opposite of where my sister was coming at about 100 miles an hour. And at the last moment, my sister tried to avoid a collision, but this driver, who was in a 20-year-old very large Suburban, hit her not just head on. I mean, it's so horrific that head on would have been preferred to what happened to her. This driver hit her.
take your time.
Hit her at an oblique angle, sort of like a T-bone. And when you have a Suburban going 100 miles an hour, with no brakes applied, she hit my sister pretty hard. My sister passed away later that evening. And as we learned about the details of this driver, we just became horrified. I was actually in San Francisco just getting off a plane, and I get a frantic call from my family that something horrible had happened. And the other horrible thing was that my father was actually just at church. He's a trauma surgeon in Chillicothe, and he was notified from the highway patrol, who walked up and knocked on their door. He then made his way to the local hospital, where my sister was at that point still alive. It was beginning to rain, so the air care couldn't fly. And then my father proceeded to drive up with the ambulance to Ohio State, where horrifically the ambulance got lost, and then brought her to Ohio State, where they attempted resuscitation in the trauma room, and where she passed away in front of our entire family. The other hard part to stomach was that the woman who killed my sister was in the next trauma room, and she survived. And so that's a little bit of kind of the details of what happened to Annie.
Now, this made your family pretty determined, though. You became advocates for getting Annie's Law passed and for changing the law, didn't you?
We did. I have a sister in Columbus who's an attorney. I have lots of attorneys and physicians in our family. And when we began to try to understand what led up to this. If you turn the clock back days and weeks and months and years, this was sort of inevitable, sadly. The person who killed my sister, who was still incarcerated, had been arrested for OVI 5 times that we knew of. She had been arrested as recently as 9 months before. She had been convicted one of those 5 times. And as we tried to understand what other states have done to try to prevent this, we sort of realized that Ohio was really falling behind legislatively to put deterrence, to put the best technology that we have in place to save our citizens. And we became enraged that nothing had been done. And fortunately, I was introduced to the wonderful people of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. And it's not that it was new to them. I mean, they had been working on these legislative efforts in every state of the union and Ohio for 6 years without success. So there was a lot of groundswell that had been there, just hadn't been successful yet.
How difficult was it? In other words, how much support were you getting from the Ohio lawmakers when you went out there and said, we need to change the law, we need to make it tougher, we need to do some things about this? What kind of reaction did you get? What kind of support did you get? Was it tough to do that?
It was very tough. It took us, so this happened in 2013, and we were up within a month talking to some legislators that we knew from our districts. And they were aware of this issue. They just hadn't had success in the past. So we began the long process of building a coalition to try to get some momentum. And we were fortunately able to find amazing, we introduced it in the House initially, and they became our champions and were able to sort of move this along. It just took a lot longer than we ever anticipated. I mean, once we started pushing, it was almost 3 years later that the law finally went through. So,
but has it been worth the effort for
all
that work?
Yeah. Absolutely, sure.
Yeah. Judge, what is in Annie's Law? What does it say specifically?
You know, first of all, let me say, Walt, to you and your family, that it's how sorry I am for your loss and how regrettable it is that it takes a situation like this to bring about positive changes in the law. Basically, as it's being implemented, it went into effect on April the 6th, and there are kind of three primary components to the changes in the law, one of which is the mandatory minimum driving suspension for a first-time OVI offender is increased. It previously, under prior law, was 6 months. That was a mandatory minimum. Now it's 1 year, and then it goes up to a period of 3 years for a first-time offense. And then it was also intended to increase the maximum possible suspension for a multiple prior OVI offender. So for a individual who has a second OVI offense within a 10-year period, I'll talk about that in a moment, the maximum suspension is up to 7 years. And for a third within a 10-year period is up to a maximum of 12 years. The other issue that really is one of the key components to the statute is that the look-back period to determining when penalties are increased. It previously was 6 years. So if somebody had a OVI offense and they then have a second OVI offense, if that second OVI offense occurred within a six-year period, we call that a look-back window, penalties for that second multiple offender would be increased. Now this look-back period is increased to 10 years. So now we bring in, there'll be an increase that we are starting to see with individuals who will be treated as a multiple prior offender and be subject to the mandatory minimum and maximum penalties as a result of the changes to Annie's Law. The other primary change involves individuals who are charged with a first-time OVI offense. And for those individuals with the mandatory minimum driving suspension period being increased to 1 year, attorneys or defendants who are charged can make a request to have unlimited driving privileges while they're suspended with the guardian interlock device or an ignition interlock device. So that would then ensure that an individual who is trying to operate a motor vehicle, that they are not operating it with alcohol in their system. So if a person opts to get the guardian interlock, and a judge grants that because it is discretionary with the court as to whether to allow someone unlimited driving privileges with the interlock device. So if that occurs and the person is successful in completing the interlock driving suspension, the court will then suspend or cut in half the duration of the license suspension, and also any jail time that would be imposed, that would also be suspended. So that's basically the gist. Now, if somebody is unsuccessful while they're using a guardian interlock device, then the penalties can be increased. The driving suspension can be doubled. So that kind of is a general overview of the statutory changes.
What's the difference between DUI and OVI?
Sure. Yeah, let me back up just so everyone understands that in Ohio, it used to be called DUI, driving under the influence. Several years ago, they changed the terminology, I guess you would say, to OVI, which is operating a vehicle under the influence. Some people say operating a vehicle while impaired. So in Ohio, you can be charged with OVI in two primary situations. One is if you are driving a motor vehicle with a prohibited blood alcohol level, or your drugs or alcohol in your system, and it exceeds the legal limit of either your blood, breath, or urine. So that is what we call a per se statutory violation. The other type of OVI charge is driving while impaired. And if an individual is operating a motor vehicle and their ability to operate that vehicle is appreciably or noticeably impaired, that is sufficient to convict someone of driving under the influence. So you can actually have two charges. Some people might refuse to take the test, and if they refuse to take the test and the officer still believes that they're impaired, they'll be charged with driving while impaired. So it's all really the same thing ultimately. OVI and DUI are all the same.
So OVI, though, and you're talking about reaching a certain level. For instance, it's 0.08, is that right?
0.08
alcohol level?
Correct.
Okay. So that would be OVI if they've actually taken some kind of a measurement. But then impaired is if an officer sees you crossing the yellow line multiple times and maybe you fail that test out on the road. That would be
– Correct.
If that would based be upon, DWI.
Right. Well, it's all still called OVI.
Okay.
So it's also called OVI. It's just there are two basic different ways that you can be charged with a OVI violation. And that is either testing a per se prohibited level or being impaired based upon the officer's observations and your performance on the field sobriety tests.
We will continue our discussion about Annie's Law, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. Here to discuss Annie's Law, which imposes stricter penalties on drunk drivers, are the Honorable Kurt Kissinger, a judge on the Hamilton County Municipal Court and chair of the court's Criminal and Traffic Law Committee, Teresa Hayes, state director with Life Safer, an ignition interlock provider, and Dr. Walt Rooney, Annie Rooney's older brother, and he also sits on the National Board of Directors of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. You can join our conversation at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Walt, how much of a relief is it for you and your family to finally see this law taking effect?
It's been a great relief. I think the trips up to Columbus, sometimes every week, sometimes multiple times a week, could be really a gauntlet. And I think that unless you've been victimized by this, I don't think people really would ever subject themselves to that. For example, I mean, there are legislators. There's actually a local legislator who had experience and didn't think DUI really was a problem. I mean, we've seen some explicit descriptions from some legislators up there that while they were sympathetic to what happened to us, they didn't really view this really as an issue. They thought the problem was solved. And in one case, a legislator around here has actually recently been charged for a DUI. So I think that it was a big challenge to emotionally not just tell the story, but push through the pushback that we got.
I'm amazed to hear that there are people who actually think that this is not an ongoing problem.
And I think the way that it's presented to us to justify that was, well, especially if someone who has their first time arrest and conviction, should be viewed as if this is the first time they've driven drunk. And we have good data from the CDC that if you are arrested and therefore convicted, this potentially was one of 50 to 100 times that you've driven drunk. There's just statistically not enough manpower to catch you every time you've been drunk once. So we don't view a one-time convicted person as an oops. This is someone who's got a chronic problem. And 0.08, you are very impaired, and that's sometimes misunderstood.
How many other states have laws similar to Annie's Law?
Ohio was almost number 30. The way that the Mothers Against Drunk Driving categorizes this, they look at it as, does the state have a first-time 0.08 BAC all-offender interlock bill? And initially, that's what we had pushed for. The bill in Ohio is very incentivized, but it's not mandatory. So in other words, there is some leeway to not use these for someone who gets a first-time conviction.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk to Vernon in Cincinnati. Hi, Vernon.
Yeah, how are you?
Good, thank you.
Yeah, I was listening to this. It sounds really good. I mean, and that Rooney, I remember an older gentleman named Rooney who's a lawyer. But anyway, make a long story short, they have this analog device put in. Now, you got that in there. What's to stop this individual from getting in somebody else's car and driving their car? Is there a penalty for that, or what's going to stop them?
Okay, Vernon, thank you for the question.
Well, let me say there is nothing that would stop a person from doing that. However, when driving privileges are granted by the court, it is with the expectation and the order is that you will drive a vehicle that has the guardian interlock. So if in the event you are driving a motor vehicle that does not have the guardian interlock, that is a separate criminal charge in and of itself, driving under an OVI suspension. And there's a mandatory, it's a misdemeanor of the first degree, maximum penalty is 180 days in jail, and there's a mandatory 3 days in jail for that. So there are consequences for trying to do that or any type of activity to circumvent the implementation of the guardian interlock.
And Teresa, describe how this interlock works. Tell us how this system works.
Basically, it's hardwired into the ignition switch of the car, and you have to blow a test, successfully pass the test, and then your car will start. Not only will it start, but you have to blow while you're driving. So it is going to test you randomly while you're driving. And if you cannot pass the test, it's not going to shut your car off, but it does make you continue to repeat, try to take a test on it.
Now, how reliable are these, though? How effective are these at reducing drunk driving?
I find them, in the many years that I've been doing this, I found that it has helped a lot. Unfortunately, with the Rooney family, as far as I know, the lady that killed their sister had never been ordered to have the ignition interlock. I've found over the years of doing this, basically was dealing with second-time offenders, and they said, if I had this on the first time, I wouldn't have gotten a second one. It's actually a behavior modification program is what it is. I can't catch everybody all the time, but I've saved a lot of lives.
So it is having an impact.
Oh, it's having a big impact.
Yeah. 513-419-7100. Chris in Cincinnati joins us. Hi, Chris.
Hey, how you doing?
Good, thanks.
My comment is that I feel that education needs to be increased on this stuff. You know, you definitely can't have guys drinking and driving, but the legal limits are way too low. I'm one of the guys that has a .081 DUI. I have it on my record. I spent 10 days in jail. I lost a good job over it. One beer is what it took me to get to that level. I'm kind of a smaller guy, but still, it's enough to have taught me not to drink and drive ever again. I don't want to spend my time in jail, but it also is a little extreme for a pretty fit 24-year-old that could stand on his head while he had that one beer. I feel that the laws are a little rough there.
Okay.
Walt? You know, the neurologic impairment that occurs when you ingest enough alcohol to get well below 0.08 is very sound scientifically. And there seems to be, I hear this a lot, that, well, you know, a 0.08 could be a standard 98-pound person who's leaving a Reds game, and why would you ruin my Reds game experience or a wedding with just that? And I think that's really a myth. And I think if you look at the average male or female, the average woman takes maybe 6 drinks over 2 hours to get 0.08. I mean, the average woman in this country weighs over 160 pounds. And so that's not a very likely story that you could have one alcohol drink. Now, I think if you had one over, multiple drinks over a couple hours, that could sort of tip you over. But when you study people who've had, up to 0.08, these aren't people who are just having a beer or two. They are really impaired. And so I've heard that a lot, that it's just one beer for my wife at a wedding. And that's just actually a myth.
The caller was saying, too, he could stand on his head even at 0.08. I question, though, sometimes you hear people were 0.08 maybe too high. I mean, they're impaired at a lower blood alcohol level.
Absolutely. And in fact, the recommendation from the federal government is that all states go to 0.05. There are many industrialized countries that are already 0.05. So when you interact with someone, even at 0.05, certainly at 0.08, there is no way you'd let them get in a car. And let me just make a similar point. If your surgeon, and I'm your surgeon, imagine if your surgeon came in and said, I just had 4 or 5 beers. I'm not quite at 0.08. And, I know this tumor is really close to your brain, but listen, I'm fine. I'm fine. I think it would be looked at a little differently.
And Mark, let me say too that the way the law is written, as I indicated earlier, that there are really two separate DUI or OVI violations. One is that per se legal limit. The other is if somebody is appreciably or noticeably impaired. So you can have somebody who may blow, or the result is a 0.05 or a 0.04 or less. And because of whatever the situation is, or a combination of factors, lack of sleep or whatever it might be, that their ability is still impaired based upon the officer's observations and the field sobriety test. So when you have that situation, it doesn't rise and fall necessarily specifically with the high test. It could also be that the evidence is there that demonstrates that person, whatever their metabolism is, that the alcohol is impairing their ability to engage in those divided attention skills, because that's what's really being tested. Your ability to operate a motor vehicle is very based upon your ability to discern certain things that are approaching you. You're maneuvering the vehicle and engaging in divided attention skills, which are impaired or diminished based upon the consumption of alcohol. So that's what really is kind of being tested. So somebody who is, again, impaired may be so and not just necessarily be over the legal limit.
Teresa, we had the one caller earlier who was talking about how do you cheat the system, right? Can you get somebody else to just get in somebody else's car and drive it? I was curious about the ignition interlock device. Is it possible for them to have a false positive? Sometimes you hear, I've heard pizza, for instance, since it has yeast in it. Can cause a false positive. I'm not so sure how true that is, but I mean, what's the case with these?
There are some false positives. I won't deny that. Whereas, you may be eating pizza while you're driving. How they do that, I'll never know. But the sauce and things like that are in it could give you a false positive. Tell them rinse their mouth out with water. Retest again. If your reading does go down under our set settings at 0.025, which are well below the legal limit, then I would say that's a false positive. If not, and you continue to blow, it's going to continually to rise, then, it's definitely alcohol readings. And all these reports go over to the courts, probation, wherever they come from. Basically, you are given instructions. You're giving, at the time of installation, we take you through a very intense training program. We show you a video. We give you a handbook. We personally tell you. And you don't want to see me when you blow to fail. I'm worse than your probation officer. I'm going to get you. You're going to tell me the truth, because fact of the matter is you're on this because you did something wrong. We're saving other people's lives. and I'm saving yours, whether you want me to or not.
Is it possible for somebody else to take the test for?
Absolutely, absolutely. And that happens quite often. And when that happens and when they abort and we see that they abort and, you know, two or three aborts, so I'm like, okay, all right, honey, who blew into this for you? And I'll take it to the court and I'll say, you know what? I think we need to promote this person to a camera unit. So therefore, we could see who's blowing into the machine.
The other built-in countermeasure that has really addressed this are rolling retests. And so if someone, for instance, is sober and blows to start a drunk person's car and they drive off, well, a couple minutes later, that person driving will be prompted to give another breath sample. And so if they cannot do that, then, you know, they're going to be recorded. A lot of these devices, it is going to be mandatory to have cameras in a few years. And so it's really difficult to do that. The first time, this question gets asked everywhere I go. The first time, yes, we'll have our sober friend, you know, let us drive. But those countermeasures that have been instituted, these technologies have really eliminated that as a circumvention.
And Kurt, if you get wind of that, they're really in trouble, right?
Usually that's the case. And as Therese was saying, when there is a violation, it's brought to my attention. And let me just say, in Annie's law, it really is kind of laid out in more detail as to what the penalties should be for someone who continues to have positive readings while with the guardian interlock, or, you know, they're locked out, can't start the vehicle. I've heard umpteen different explanations. You know, we talk from mouthwash, you mentioned the yeast, and there's so many different explanations, but Teresa's company and companies that provide interlock devices are very skilled at figuring out what it is, because if you use mouthwash but you continue to test positive and can't start your vehicle, that's a pretty good indication it's alcohol, oftentimes alcohol from the night prior that is still in their system, and because mouthwash will go out pretty quickly and you'll be able to start your vehicle. But I've had all different, the one I had somebody one time who, before they decided to go out that night, took balloons and blew air into balloons. And ultimately it didn't work. So they got stopped, or they couldn't start their vehicle. They were in a parking lot. Police officer showed up and saw multiple balloons in the vehicle that they were intending to try to use that pre-alcohol consumption air to put into the device to get it to work. So it didn't work.
Teresa's shaking her head like, no, this is not going to happen.
It's not going to happen. That's why our devices are changed, so that for the anti-circumvention. You know, that's the very reason it's set up like that. There's a technique to blowing into it, and each company has their own little circumvention ways. With the Lifesaver, you blow hum. With the Guardian, you blow and until you hear the second beep, and then you inhale. So it's not easy to do this. That's why we take you through an intense training, and unless you come through one of our offices and been taught, you're not going to know how to do it. And it's you're going to tell on yourself. We're going to get you.
But one of the things along these lines that have been frustrating for not just my family, but victims of all people of this crime, which, by the way, is 100% preventable crime, is that there is a defense attorney that's gone on some TV stations in Northern Ohio and essentially trying to discredit the validity of the interlock device and saying, listen, they're false positives. You need me as your attorney. And what I'm saying is that, I mean, any sort of a technology that's trying to save our citizens can be worked around. And this just looks like another attempt to put more of your listeners who are driving across, they're driving down the street and the people coming across from them, they're putting them more impaired than they should be. And this infuriates me, and it infuriates the victims when you hear that you're trying to discredit this public health policy. I mean, I just want to go over this. This is not a punitive issue. This is not shaming. This is a public health policy device to protect all of us. And I have panic attacks literally when I have to put my kids in the car seat and drive down Route 50 and there are people coming on the opposite lane that I know are impaired, that I potentially know are impaired and that have been arrested, not convicted, and put out there because some defense has discredited some evidence. And going after this interlock device, to me, it's unconscionable because these things have been tested for many decades and millions of times. And so this false positive, it's a red herring. It's to scare people of the law.
But defense attorneys also try to take on the breathalyzers that the police are using as well.
Sure.
It's just part of that.
Right, and saying they're not calibrated. You know, they use that as a defense. Well, they give them a breathalyzer test, but when was the last time this was calibrated? You know, and they always come up with some excuse, and it's just those attorneys that are trying to make a buck off of somebody else. But my thing is to all these people that want to go out here and drink and drive, did you get up this morning and say, I think I'm going to go get drunk and kill somebody? No, but it could happen. What's going to happen when it happens to one of your family members? Then you'll think differently.
We will continue our conversation. You can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Caney. Here to discuss Annie's Law, which imposes stricter penalties on drunk drivers, are the Honorable Kirk Kissinger, a judge on the Hamilton County Municipal Court and chair of the court's Criminal and Traffic Law Committee, Teresa Hayes, state director with Life Safer, an ignition interlock provider, and Dr. Walt Rooney, Annie Rooney's older brother, and he also sits on the National Board of Directors of Mothers Against Drunk Driving. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. So, Teresa, we were talking before the break about calibrating these devices. How often do they need to be calibrated?
Every time a client comes in for service, and we monitor them every 30 days, 28 to 30 days. Some people do it every 60 days, but I prefer to do 28 to 30 days. And we actually blow an alcohol solution into it ourselves and calibrate the unit. They have to be tested. If the unit is not good, if it's not reading the proper levels of alcohol, you know, it will tell us to send it back to be repaired. So these devices are downloaded constantly. Even if they come in for a reset, they lock themselves out, they have to come in for a reset. We calibrate the unit then. That system is constantly being calibrated. And then we have state training and standards team that comes out and checks every center I have here in Ohio to make sure that all of our equipment is working properly, our simulators are working properly, we're using the proper procedures. So we're checks and balances all the time.
513-419-7100 to join us. Let's talk to Al in Cincinnati. Hi, Al.
Hey, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I want to thank the judge and everyone there that are addressing the issue. And I also want to say how sorry I am to the families that have been victims of people that are operating vehicles under the influence. Quickly, I'm working on a dissertation on this particular issue, and what I found is that the issue is somewhat simple. One, we have people that are operating vehicles under the influence. Two, we have in place laws that are trying to address those issues, and technology in place regarding interlock, et cetera, to try to keep those people off the road. But what I'm finding out from a duty breach causation damage perspective, where we're dropping the ball is the monitoring of those individuals that have gone through the system and have been convicted and gone through the driver's intervention program or Turning Point, et cetera, and are going through random urine screens. The number of individuals that officers are mandated to monitor compliance, there's not enough resources to stay on top of all those people. And I would argue that if there was a way to have a private partnership with a for-profit business model that was operating against the public sector, to see if they could use some modern technology, some modern business principles to effectively monitor people that are supposed to stay in compliance. So if the model is you get a check every week with the same amount of money, regardless of whether or not the people that you're supervising are reoffending, there's really no incentive to go the extra mile. But if your bottom line is going to be based on the number of people that aren't reoffending, the number of people that have successfully gone through treatment, and that's going to determine what type of money you make, then there's an incentive factor to go the extra mile.
But now, Al, if I understand you correctly, what you're arguing for then would be to have a public sector and a private sector working together, see which one works the best in the monitoring. Is that what you're saying?
Exactly. In other words, what I'm saying is that, you know, if you got 200 people on a caseload, and you got all these precinct investigation reports you have to do, and you have people coming in, and you're asking them, are you drinking? No, I'm not drinking. Well, how do I know if you're not drinking unless I do a urine screen? Well, I can't urine screen every person that comes in. Somebody's going to come into the probation department and say, yeah, I've been drinking. Yeah, I'm doing this. They're going to come in. They come in and report, and you say, you know,
Let's let our guest weigh in on this.
It's a good point that you make, and I think that this is a perfect example of when you talk about the public-private partnership. Obviously, in the court system, where we have limited resources, we have a limited number of probation officers. As you indicated, we can't, you know, have everyone submit to random urine screens. You have to prioritize, especially now with the heroin epidemic. You know, resources have to be properly allocated. So we do that in the court system as best we can, but with this conversation and the guardian interlock device is that it is that private component that helps supplement our probationary resources. So we know if somebody has a guardian interlock device in their car, we feel very comfortable that they are not drinking and driving. And if in the event there is a violation, that is brought to the court's attention. But that information is garnered from the interlock company and provided to the probation department. And we have a couple probation officers that are specifically handle individuals who are on interlock. So this is kind of falls right into what you're saying. We're basically utilizing as a court system the interlock device company to help monitor those people we have on interlock.
And I'd like to add to that as well. And all of our court systems with our particular brands are able to go in and look at anybody's report online themselves. So every client that's on this program, their assigned monitor can look at these reports as well as any violations now are being sent over to the Bureau of Motor Vehicles. So we're working with the Bureau of Motor Vehicles to get them more in line too, because everyone is required to have an ignition interlock license now that has an ignition interlock in their vehicle. And this is going to help prevent a lot of scamming and driving other cars, because they have to, when they get pulled over, they show those license, the police officer is going to be looking for the ignition interlock. If it's not in there, they're going to get arrested immediately, I would assume. I would hope so. And their car impounded. So we are thinking of different ways of bringing this in where more people are monitoring, more people are watching it.
I would like to also add that one of the issues that came up during the legislative process was, would there be a fair market for interlock devices to compete and keep the price down that would go to the state? And I would also like to say that the interlock device is paid for by the offender. So this is mostly revenue neutral. And that was a big, big component that was very important. And there are multiple interlock manufacturers that compete, keep the price low, and that function in Ohio.
Luke called in with a question. He wants to know if a breath test is required when you're pulled over. And he also wanted to know if a field sobriety test is just as accurate.
The answer is the officer has to have probable cause to believe that you are impaired. So based upon the officer's observations, whether that's how they're operating the vehicle, weaving, things of that nature, and if the officer detects an odor of alcohol or sees other indicia of alcohol impairment, watery bloodshot eyes, slurred speech, delayed reaction, things of that nature, and they have them do field sobriety tests. And it's just individuals do not have to do the field sobriety tests. But an officer still can make an arrest decision based upon the information that they have available to them that may not include field sobriety tests. And if that's the case, and the officer has probable cause, they can require the individual to submit to a breath test. Now, the individual does not have to submit to the test, be it either blood, breath, or urine, and there are consequences for that decision. Now, again, if you do not test and the officer believes there is sufficient evidence that you are impaired, then you can still be charged with OVI and prosecuted accordingly.
Interesting. Sean in Dayton says he thinks the breath test and the field test are too often left up to the discretion of the officer.
That is a criticism we often hear. Is the results only as good as the officer and the knowledge and skill of the officer performing the test? And oftentimes it is a subjective analysis. Body-worn camera, in-car video. So it kind of takes some of that subjectivity out because as a judge or the trier of fact, we can watch that evidence and see whether the person is performing those field sobriety tests as directed. So that is a criticism we often hear. But again, oftentimes it's up to the judge or the jury to decide whether that evidence is sufficient.
So, Walt, where's the technology taking us in terms of reducing drunk driving? There's some interesting things out there, built-in breath analyzers in cars, and the other thing I think is called spectrometry.
Sure.
Yeah. Is that where we're headed now?
It is. And the way I like conceptually to think about Interlox and then the future technology is, you know, the same way we think about polio or infectious disease that we have vaccines for. So conceptually, this device and the future technology is a way to vaccinate the car. So take out the decision-making process of someone who's impaired and just try to vaccinate the car with technology that will prevent it from starting if the driver's impaired. And so there's a really interesting program that has a prototype car, the driver detecting for safety. It's I'll just go to the acronym. It's DADSS. You can look that up, Google that. And it essentially has an automobile that has two ways to measure your blood alcohol content passively. One is a touch-based system that could either be on the key fob or the steering wheel. And the other is just an ambient detection of alcohol in the essentially cockpit part of the driving space. And so we're hoping that that's funded from the federal government for the next 5 years. We're hoping that that sort of leads to a widespread implementation of this technology that would be passively used to detect impairment on all production cars. And so, you know, these things take a long time, and I think they would be voluntary at the beginning. But I think from an insurance company perspective, you know, why would you want a car on the road that doesn't really have this technology? So we're excited about that. And that technology, the more I read about it, was really one of the few things that could get me through the really, really dark times, to know that there is technology that hopefully can make this 100% preventable crime to make us have no more victims.
But you're saying this would be like an option on a car, just like the a lot of the other options you can get. You could get this as an option, at least initially.
Right.
Right?
That's right.
Okay. But insurance companies, you think they'd incentivize this at some point and say, we'll give you a lower rate if you do this? Is that how you're looking at it?
Absolutely. I think that as an insurance company, from their business model perspective, if you have something that can drastically reduce, you know, what sort of claims they're going to pay out, they're going to heavily incentivize it. But right now, the plan is for it to be voluntary. And let me just go over that again. Driver Alcohol Detection System for Safety, DADSS. You can Google that, and it talks a lot about it.
And then again, this will be a device perhaps built into the steering wheel that could sense your breath when you exhale. And or the other option is something that you touch that can pick up on your blood alcohol level.
Yes, and the big step forward technology-wise is that it makes it passive. In other words, there's not... The breathalyzer actually is about the size of an iPhone with a little place to blow on it. But that takes active participation by the driver. This would be passive. In other words, it would just randomly, if your hands are on the steering wheel, it would randomly be testing your blood alcohol concentration.
Is there any idea how long it'll be before these are actually in cars, or do they have any kind of a time frame?
Well, we're hoping within 5 to 10 years. I mean, we have a prototype that's functional right now. It's just getting the economics right from the car makers.
Thank you, everybody, for joining me this afternoon. Hamilton County Municipal Court Judge and Chair of the Court's Criminal and Traffic Law Committee, Kurt Kissinger, State Director with Life Safer, Teresa Hayes, and Dr. Walt Rooney.